we have with us live in the studios. Once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Yeah. Plenty to cover. Starting with the Minutemen.
Yeah, well, the Minutemen, that sounds very familiar for anybody who's been tracking the various murders on the far right and assassinations over the past couple of months, where the various associated groups on the far right first condemn and say, we don't really use violence and we don't really know this person, but oh, by the way, this is a horrible, horrible problem that were originally, they try and use the media attention to get coverage for their cause. And Everett Woman was one of three people, and somebody from Eastern Washington State was another, who were arrested in Arizona for the murder of a father and a 9-year-old daughter as part of an apparent
home
invasion robbery, where they were trying to kill people to not leave any witnesses. The mother survived by finding a gun in the house and firing back, wounding one of the invaders, and his being treated at a hospital for a gunshot wound was what led to the arrest. So, let me see if I have this straight. Mexican immigration is a horrible problem. This, according to the Everett Woman, who was ran actually for Everett City Council a couple of years ago, and was
Snohomish City Council or Snohomish County Council.
Was it Snohomish County Council?
Yeah, I thought so.
Oh, well, in any event, she was a person who was known in Snohomish County, let's put it that way. She believed that the Mexican drug cartels and illegal immigrants were not only a horrible, horrible problem, but that they were out to get her. She'd actually reported an attempted rape that she thought was essentially sponsored by Mexican drug cartels and so forth.
And then she later told police that she thought a couple of thugs that hung around with her son were involved.
Yeah, exactly. So this is a woman who has apparently some problems. To put it very mildly. But this once again is a pattern that we have seen before. And this robbery attempt, she had split off from the main Minutemen group and was apparently attempting to finance her group by invading the homes of these Mexican Americans, because you Mexicans, they all have drug money and they're all washing cash, and that's probably all at their homes. And wound up shooting and killing a 9-year-old daughter as a result of this. It's really a very tragic story. But once again, we have a case where the very violent and hysterical rhetoric on the far right leads some people who have some mental problems to latch onto this sort of stuff and believe it and act out on those beliefs in ways that are very, very dangerous. And since the election of Obama, and especially in the past couple of months, we've seen this on several cases. We saw it in the Knoxville shootings, the shootings in Pittsburgh, the assassination of George Tiller. The list goes on. Now this very tragic story in Arizona with a local connection. And
well, in addition,
there really is a straight line to the rhetoric that's coming out of the far right.
Yeah, and in addition, in the last 8 years or so, for reasons people probably could understand, the federal government has largely turned a blind eye to these right-wing militia-type organizations. The INS seems to welcome the help of the
ICE
Minutemen.
Well, ICE now. It's not INS anymore.
Yes, seems to welcome the help of the Minutemen. And the FBI obviously is not keeping very good tabs on what some of these folks are doing. Apparently, not just this woman from Everett was a problem, but also one of her cohorts who had been in prison before. And once he was released from prison, he spent quite a bit of time in Hayden Lake, Idaho, with the Aryan Nations, a person who you probably would not want to get anywhere near any kind of immigration issue. And yet these
and
folks...
a person who shouldn't have access to firearms either.
Right, and these folks were welcomed into the Minutemen at first before they were booted out and then tried to start their own organization, and yet she continued to go to various Minutemen organization gatherings and be welcomed there. So I think the real question is, how come the federal government and the FBI turn a blind eye to these kind of organizations, and do we really want to have these vigilante groups not just operating in the border areas, but apparently they have chapters that recruit from all over the United States. The Washington State Minutemen Group goes down and works on the border. So why the heck are Americans who live in Washington State spending time in places like Arizona policing the U.S.-Mexico border? You know, folks who have not gone through a real background check, even though the Minutemen Group says they do a background check. Apparently, they didn't care that this woman's son was in prison and that her friends had been in prison and had connections to the Aryan Nations. I mean, how can that actually happen if the FBI and the ICE are actually paying attention and doing their real jobs and not turning a blind eye to this kind of thing?
And once again, when you have a definition of terrorist as somebody who uses violence in order to advance their political goals, even when innocent civilians are involved, there are an awful lot of terrorist groups operating in the U.S. right now. Most of them are not Muslim. Most of them are on the far right, and they're not getting the kind of attention they should be getting from the Department of Homeland Security.
Yeah, and the FBI devotes a lot of resources to go after animal rights groups, for example, for charges that they've destroyed property, and yet they don't seem to devote much in resources to go after people with violent backgrounds like this. It's insane.
All right, moving on to national and healthcare bill.
Yeah, the healthcare bill, we talked about it some last week, seems to be running into roadblocks, especially in the Senate. Now, the House released their version of it. Basically, what they did is they said, this is our wish list, this is what we want in a healthcare bill, but they didn't include any kind of mechanism for funding that. They've left it all up to the Senate to figure out how to find the money to pay for it. And this week, the Congressional Budget Office released a cost estimate of $1.6 trillion for the Senate version of the bill. And that just completely stunned Senate Democrats. They were like, how can it be that much money? And now they're scrambling to find ways to pay for the bill. And they're looking at it thinking, we got to cut as much as a third of what's in this healthcare reform bill in order to make it cost less so that we can afford it. So we're beginning to see the hacking away of benefits out of a bill that some people would argue is kind of minimally what we may need.
And you see this concern over the price tag, and so they're trying to save $600 billion, which is a lot of money, but it's a drop in the bucket compared to the amount of money over the past 8 months that's been thrown at Wall Street. And we're talking about, you know, not the benefit of a few high-powered banks. We're talking about money that would go to provide health care for all Americans. It really does show where Washington D.C.'s priorities are right now. Now, the House and Senate versions of the bill that we have right now are going to be modified a lot before whatever turns out to be the final bill is passed this fall. But what we're seeing right now is the broad outlines of what is possible. In other words, you're not going to see anything that's any better than what is already on the table. What you're going to see is further compromises to appease the Republican Party and further compromises to try and pass it through Congress and get it on the president's desk. So it's not going to be any better than what it is right now. What it's going to be is you're going to see even more pieces of this that are designed to benefit the insurance companies, the drug companies, the companies that make all their money off of health care to ensure that their ox isn't gored by any of this.
Yeah, and I think the two most alarming things in the attempt to make the bill cost less is they're talking about taxing some of the health care benefits that people receive through their jobs as income. And, for example, if you receive, if you are covered through your employer and your employer pays the premiums on your health insurance, then you would take the amount of those premiums into your income and pay tax on them, even though you don't receive the cash. You do receive the benefits. So the Senate is considering that as one way to pay for the bill. They're also looking at, too, cuts in Medicare in order to make it all work, which to me is just like, that's insane. you're gonna talk about providing a little bit of coverage to a few more Americans, and you're going to do it on the backs of the poor. That just makes absolutely no sense.
Medicare or Medicaid?
Medicare.
All right. Anything else on that?
Well, also there's an issue of timing. The bill has been stalled in the Finance Committee in the Senate. Senator Max Back, Backus has said that the bill won't be released from committee until after the July 4th recess, which means, of course, it won't get through Congress before the August break, which is going to slow it down quite a bit. And as it makes its slow way through the Senate, we're going to see lots and lots and lots of changes. So
most of them not good.
Most of them not good, yeah. Although, you know, there are groups trying to work to introduce alternative bills as well. I don't know how far those will go, but there's some good options that are being put out there.
All right. Moving on to the Supreme Court and a DNA ruling.
Yeah, the Supreme Court ruled in a 5-4 decision this week, with the conservatives prevailing, of course, that prisoners don't have a constitutional right to DNA testing of evidence after their conviction. Justice John Roberts, who wrote for the majority, decided that it would be best to leave this decision to state legislatures, not to the courts. He wrote with the concurrence of Justices Scalia, Kennedy, Thomas, and Alito that, quote, a criminal defendant proved guilty after a fair trial does not have the same liberty interests as a free man, end quote, which seems really specious to me. I mean, we do allow the rights of appeal to defendants who have been convicted, with the understanding that we do not have a perfect system, and that the idea of, quote, a fair trial is an ideal not always reached in the U.S. court system. However, of course, this is a rich man's conceit, the assumption that everyone can afford and will automatically receive a fair trial. So, of course, four justices ruled against it, but of course the majority wins in this case. But I want to just say that not all states have the same rules regarding DNA testing. Some only allow it in death penalty cases after a conviction, and some disallow it if a defendant pleads guilty. But as folks probably know, defendants plead guilty for all kinds of reasons, including strategic ones like to avoid the death penalty and win a sentence that is, for example, life in prison. But if you're innocent, it's nice to have the DNA testing done.
The whole ruling basically seems to be based on the premise that it's more important to preserve the outcome of a trial, regardless of whether it's accurate or not, than to actually find out whether a person is innocent or guilty.
Yeah, and according to the Innocence Project, which is involved in helping folks who have been convicted to get DNA testing done on the evidence that was used in their trial, according to the Innocence Project, 240 people have had their convictions overturned because of DNA testing after they were convicted. 17 of those people had received the death penalty, and among those who had their convictions overturned, 20% of them had given up claiming that they were innocent for legally strategic reasons and for other reasons. So those are folks who had allowed themselves to plead guilty or had given up on claiming that they were innocent. 20% of 240 people, that's a lot of people. So in this case, you know, I think leaving it to individual states to have different rules regarding this is just a cop-out. The Supreme Court, the lower court, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, had recognized the right to DNA testing under the Due Process Clause of the Constitution, and essentially Justice Roberts and the other conservative justices had said, well, no, that's not important.
It's also a cop out to leave the determination of whether a fair trial should be defined by, you know, the outcome of a trial, whether it's flawed or not, to the legislative process rather than the judicial process, because
yeah,
there's all kinds of political pressures that are put on legislators to be tough on criminals, et cetera, that can jaundice their views on this.
It is definitely a court issue, and Justice Roberts didn't think so.
All right. Let's move on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, the Obama administration released their regulatory reform plan to Congress, saying this is what we want you to work on. And what I think most interesting about it is that it had a lot to say about changing the organization of regulatory agencies, but it didn't do a lot of putting in place new regulations. First, I'd like to just talk a little bit about what it contains. It would set up a new consumer financial protection agency that would govern credit cards, auto loans, student loans, home mortgages, all the financial products that consumers encounter. It would expand powers for the Federal Reserve, turning them into a broad systemic risk regulator and allowing them to regulate global investment banks. It would set up a new Financial Services Oversight Council, a group of regulators led by the Treasury Department to identify systemic risks and advise the Fed, because, of course, as we know, the Fed has a little bit of trouble doing the whole regulation thing on its own. And the Treasury will create a new capital requirements for all financial companies, not just banks, which is a very welcome idea. It would set up a new national bank supervisor to oversee all federally chartered lenders, and it goes on and on. There are all kinds of things in there, including having the SEC actually regulate ratings agencies like Moody's and Standard & Poor's and Fisk, which has never been done before and is a very welcome new idea. But what it really doesn't do, as you'll notice, is it doesn't consolidate any of the alphabet soup group of organizations that currently are supposed to regulate the financial system, but which have a very spotty record. It also, having this panoply of organizations has allowed companies to kind of shop around for the most lenient group to be their regulator. And that hasn't been addressed at all with this as shuffling the deck chairs on the Titanic approach. It also gives too much power to the Fed. And if you look at who really is responsible for the economic problems we have, most folks would say, well, the Fed has fallen down on the job because they didn't regulate big banks like they should have.
And the Fed is also, out of all of these panoply of agencies, probably the least accountable and the least transparent.
Yeah, the Fed, people could argue also, was responsible for the long period of low interest rates that has driven the appetite for riskier, higher-paying investments like mortgage-backed securities. So in a sense, the Fed itself has created risk in the system rather than managed risk as the plan would have them do. Also, the Fed was supposed to regulate mortgages, and you can scratch your head right now and say, okay, the Fed was supposed to regulate mortgages? What the heck happened?
And why was it in charge of mortgages in the first place?
Right. So it's a good thing that power is being taken away from them and given to a new agency. However, the Fed is still going to have this sort of overarching power to regulate risk within the system. I'm not convinced it's up to the task. I think most of all, with this plan, the biggest problem is that there's no mechanism for stopping financial companies from getting so big that their failure can imperil the system. So there's nothing in here that would, as I said, it's reorganizing the regulatory agencies a little bit, shuffling them around a little bit, but it's not introducing new regulations, particularly on the limit of the size of companies or what they can do, which I think is probably the most necessary thing here. And this is especially important now, I think, that we're seeing consolidation in the financial system with, for example, Bank of America first buying up Countrywide Financial, which was the largest mortgage lender in the nation, and then turning around and buying Merrill Lynch, a huge brokerage service. So, you know, now we see Bank of America as this big behemoth, and there are other big behemoths like Citigroup, et cetera. Those banks are just getting bigger. They're not getting smaller. And if one of them fails, it's even more of an impact on the system than it would have been before.
Seems, instead of shuffling deck chairs on the Titanic, seems more like shuffling, moving around shells in a shell game and then trying to figure out under which shell is the regulations.
Yeah,
They never lift the shells to access the regulations in the first place. Yeah. That's the problem.
Well, and the fact is there's nothing
shells.
Really under the shells. So
they're empty shells with no regulation
That's
inside
right.
them,
yes.
At least not yet.
All right. So that pretty much wraps it up for national. Then that takes us on to international and Iran.
Yeah. Some listeners may know the last couple of years my day job has been executive director of Peace Action of Washington, and one of our main program areas has been working with Iranian Americans and trying to create a more peaceful policy between the United States and Iran and peaceful conflict resolution and so forth. So the last week has been pretty intense. A lot's going on in Iran, as people may be aware, although you wouldn't know it by looking at the Seattle Times website. But if you look at any international websites, police are cracking down on protesters in Tehran as we speak. Large protests scheduled for today, Saturday, were not allowed. Last night, an Iranian-American friend forwarded to me a eyewitness account from Iran that I want to take a moment. I don't usually do this sort of thing, but I want to take a moment and read some of it because it really encapsulates pretty well, I think, a lot of what's been happening in terms of the sense of things. This is a young Iranian woman in Tehran. A lot is happening right now. We are pushing back, and some people hear us around the world. Those sitting outside and supporting Hamas and Hezbollah, Ahmadinejad's close friends, rather than supporting their own people who suffer, should be ashamed. Those who do nothing for Iran but wait for us to give our blood so they can go back should be ashamed. We need support. There are rallies every day. Since there is no communication system available, rallies are organized by word of mouth from one event to the other, and then by phone calls and strangers just telling you to show up as they pass you by or as you're waiting behind red lights. Yesterday it was supposed to be from Enkelab to Azadi, but it literally started at Imam Hussein Square and spread all the way to butcher these Farsi names, Ekbatan. The number of protesters should be estimated in the millions. They were from every layer of society, southern Tehranis, northern rich kids, Chidoris, Gertes, Hezbollah, young, old kids, etc. A huge sample of the Iranian nation with all its diversity was there determined to make a change. They are feeling betrayed and insulted. Helicopters were flying over our heads to assess the crowds. People would wave at them and whistle and make sure they were seen so they report their presence to the authorities. The radio and TV warned people all day long not to attend, as the rally didn't have the permission from the Ministry of Interior, and warned of serious consequences if it took place, but nobody cared. Everyone went. The anti-riot police first tried to intimidate people as they were gathering, but the immensity of the crowd then made them back up and hide in a nearby police station. Yesterday, the rally was calm and peaceful until the crowd started to disperse at the end. Then armed thugs without uniforms and some anti-riot units showed up with more confidence. They started a fire in one corner of Azadi to attract and entrap the most enthusiastic of protesters, then started firing tear gas and shooting. I didn't hear it see it myself, but I heard that a man was shot in the eye. The shooters then disappeared. Chants were all either conducted against Ahmadinejad or in support of Mousavi. Nothing more sensitive than that. It's what I call smart protest. People are extremely vigilant about what to say. Apart from rallies, people cry Allah o Akbar every night around 9 p.m. from rooftops and cars. Well, it's supposed to be 9 p.m., but Iranians are always late, so they really start around 9:30. There are also sporadic riots and tire burning in town. Night riots are much more violent. Universities are really tense, too. Police and thugs have already stormed dorms a couple of times and seriously wounded students. Girls are extremely active in all these rallies, a little less in night riots where patches of young men are more visible. They courageously charge anti-riot police, chant slogans in front of them, lead the crowd, etc., but they are equally beaten too. The police seem to have no limits in the use of force. They are disproportionately violent. They don't fire weapons, but they don't go easy on you with their clubs. They literally beat protesters to death if they don't get rescued by fellow protesters or somehow break away and run. The level of brutality is exceptional, but it's amazing to see how people stand up to them. I heard from many witnesses that thugs were brought by bus from smaller cities to assist police in the crackdown. The national TV can't just keep ignoring it. Not one single word of yesterday's rally was reported last night except the really shortage footage showing Mir Hussein, that's Mousavi, standing on his car to talk to his supporters that contest the results, that in quotes. The camera didn't zoom out one bit to show the immensity of the crowd that were there for much more than just the election. Pray for protesters and for the country. Your support means a lot as people happily tell each other how Iranians abroad are gathering around embassies to support them. I testify with confidence that this is the most authentic, grassroots, and beautiful movement from the people, by the people, and for the people. No outside force, no money, no conspiracy is involved. It's all about people telling each other where to gather next time, pledge to show up, and keep their promise. There was a spirit of fraternity, determination, resistance, courage, solidarity, and generosity that no word can describe. I thank God to have seen this in my lifetime, and I wouldn't trade it for the world." That's a young woman in Tehran. Just one point that I want to make in addition to this, because we don't have a whole lot of time, that this is not about the elections anymore. It really didn't started not being about that within a day or two of the first defiance by the large crowds of the banned rallies, really a week ago today. This is about the legitimacy of the regime, and the coverage by American media in particular has been just abominable on this. You've got neocons saying, well, Ahmadinejad has won, the protesters don't really mean anything, and isn't this wonderful, because this means it's more likely we can invade Iran because it has a much more, it has a much more radical face than if Mousavi were the face, and it would be easier to deal with the reformists and negotiate, and we can't really have that. This is a direct challenge to the regime. This is the regime change that the neocons say they wanted, but it's not on their terms because it's by Iranians themselves. And there's not a whole lot we can do from the outside, from the United States in particular. I think actually Obama has been very smart so far in staying relatively quiet on this, because the regime could just use any American support for the protesters as a way to discredit them. And in fact, today apparently there are reports in the Iranian-controlled state media of a suicide bombing that hasn't been confirmed independently, where you've got state media trying to discredit the protesters by claiming that they're violent and claiming that they're tools of outside foreign influence, namely U.S. influence. So the hardliners are trying to blame this on the U.S. There's dissension among and within the hardliners, and some of the people siding with the reformists on this are veterans of the original Iranian Revolution. So it really is an unprecedented opening, and it's being used particularly by the young people in Iran to cry out for a freedom in a way that they haven't been able to in at least 30 years. A lot's going to happen in the next few days, and it's really not clear how it'll turn out, but it's been pretty inspiring so far.
And shame on the U.S. media for not covering it for what it is.
Yeah, it really has been abominable the way United States media both has not covered it at all and not seen it as important. I mean, you have to scroll way down the Seattle Times homepage this morning to even see, an AP report from last night that isn't even acknowledging what's happening right now, where it's a breaking story in major media in most parts of the world. And when they do cover it, they're covering it very badly, and they're really distorting what's actually happening.
It also speaks to the one of the benefits of all the electronic gear that we have these days, being able to get the word out, independently.
Yeah, a lot of the word has gotten out by Twitter. It's been really the first Twitter revolution, and it really has been a remarkable thing to see, getting these eyewitness accounts from Tehran that wouldn't have been possible 10 years ago.
Yeah.
All right. That pretty much leaves us time for events.
Yeah, not a whole lot going on this week in terms of events. Of course, the Fremont Festival is this weekend, and the Fremont Fair. For those of us who live in Fremont, we hide in our basements and wait for everybody to go home.
The Solstice Parade begins at noon today.
Yes, and it won't be rainy, so people can wear as little clothing as they like. And then other than that, we have the spring fund drive that ETH Estate is trying to wrap up, and coming up on, I believe it'll be July 19th, we're going to have a benefit at Not a Number to wrap that up and to celebrate with some music, and we'll have details on that coming up soon.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with ETH Estate, and tell us where we can find ETH Estate.
ETH Estate comes out every couple of weeks. You get it where you find free periodicals, web coffee shops, King County Library System, et cetera, et cetera. You can also find us on the web at www.eatthestate.org. As I mentioned, we are in the middle of a fund drive. It's an all-volunteer organization. We depend on people's donations in order to survive. So if you can help us out, we would very much appreciate it. Use the PayPal button on eatthestate.org, or send your check or money order to P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington, 98145. And if you have comments, questions, tips, or you missed any of that, our email is info@eatthestate.org.